From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. We spotlight a popular Atlanta heavy metal band, Mastodon. The group won the Grammy for Best Metal Performance this January.
Oh my God! You guys, we just won a Grammy. Thanks to my beautiful wife, Suzanne. She's up there. I love you.
We talk with Mastodon's Bron Daler. That's ahead this hour. But first, we talked yesterday about racial bias in Georgia's prisons.
I got to be honest, right? You know, when I got arrested for selling cocaine to a GBI agent, it wasn't that I was a drug dealer. I was trying to get high myself.
That's Mac Cook of Atlanta. He's African-American, arrested 38 times in his life. He finally broke the cycle by going to Drug Accountability Court, which provides resources to help keep people out of prison. The State Department of Corrections says jailing black inmates in Georgia has decreased 30% over the last 8 years. But there's still a large racial imbalance in Georgia prisons. Here are your first thoughts. Dogwood Slim tweeted, I've watched white men with felony warrants walk out of court while they revoked the probation of employed, educated black men for missing appointments. The accountability courts are a farce. They're funding the system on minor offenders. We always want to know what you think. Give us a call at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook and we might feature your comments on the program. Heavy metal band Mastodon was founded in Atlanta in 2000. After 18 years together, the group heads out on tour again for its 8th studio album. Here's the song Roots Remain from that album called Emperor of Sand. Earlier this year, Mastodon won Best Metal Performance at the Grammy Awards. Bron Daler is the band's drummer, and he also does vocals. My colleague Adam Ragusa sat down with him to talk about the group's journey.
Hello, welcome to the show, Bron.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you. I want to thank you for restoring my faith. I was becoming one of those old guys, one of those insufferable cultural declinists.
Oh, no.
Who is convinced that all of the good music happened when back in my day and there's nothing good these days. And then, you know, 3-4 years ago, I heard Mastodon for the first time. I was late to the party. And I was like, oh my God, like the one of the greatest heavy rock bands of all time is alive and touring and doing their work right now. And that just made me feel a lot better about the world. So I want to thank you.
Hey, thanks for the kind words. I appreciate it. Yes, we're old too, so, you know, it only makes sense.
Well, you know who's even older, generally speaking, is your average public radio audience. So, for people who might not be up on the music these days, could you describe the Mastodon sound?
I don't know. You know, we just sort of a blender of genres, I guess. We try to, it's rooted in heavy music because I think that's where all of us sort of cut our teeth when we were younger and started playing music. But we have a lot, we all like a vast variety of music and we are not afraid to incorporate it into our sound. So we can comfortably tour with bands like Queens of the Stone Age 1 month and then the next month jump out there with Slayer and it works somehow. So we've made that nice little place for ourselves in the gray area of musical genres.
Well, looking back at your origins in Atlanta, what was the scene that Mastodon came out of?
Well, I moved here from Rochester, New York. Well, I was living in Rochester, New York. I mean, I'm from there. And then I moved to somewhere in Massachusetts and joined a band called Today's a Day and was in that band for about 2.5 years or so and did a bunch of touring with that band. And when Bill, the guitar player in Mastodon, and myself quit that band, we moved to Atlanta because Bill's girlfriend, now wife, had gotten a job at the CDC. And she had a very small apartment on Euclid Avenue and said they had an extra room. So I took it. And, you know, Bill just kind of told me that with his experience in Atlanta, there was nothing really comparable to the kind of stuff that we were doing, you know. So if we came down there, that might be a good that might be a good thing. And that had a really good music scene. There was a lot of clubs, a lot of venues to play, which is in Rochester, even though there's a lot of really talented and awesome people up there, there's not a lot of places to play, you know? So it's kind of tough. But he said that it was sort of thriving down here, you know, there's a big rock scene and a big heavy rock scene, but not anybody doing anything like what we had been doing for many years up in Rochester. So we decided to come down here and try our luck and see if we could find any other like-minded musicians. And we did. Within a couple of weeks, everything kind of came together pretty easily. Didn't even have to put an ad in the paper. Just kind of wound up at a basement show at this place called the Parasite House at a High on Fire show, because we were High on Fire fans and Sleep fans. And then this band called 4 Hour Fogger was opening up, and that was Brent and Troy's band. Met those guys. They had heard that we were in town and that we were looking to put something together, and, you know, offered their services. Troy was like, I got a van.
Yeah, who cares if he's a great bass player and singer? He's got a van.
Exactly. I know. That was his selling point to us. You know, not that he played the bass, but he's got a van. Well, I play the bass too, but mainly I have a van so we can get to and fro our basement gigs. So, you know, things kind of came together really fast. I mean, within a couple weeks, we were already started booking a tour, and we were all kind of all systems go. You know, we were ready to jump in the van and start eating bologna sandwiches and playing in VFW halls and basements and, you know, that whole DIY scene. And in Atlanta, I think there was like the Star Bar. There still is the Star Bar, of course. Star Bar, the Earl, the Parasite House, like I mentioned. MJQ was around. Now, there was a bunch of venues to play, and we played them all. And so our first show, I think, was just about sold out, you know, at MJQ. And we played the next night at the Parasite House, and it was packed. And so we were met with a pretty unbelievable fanfare, like right off the bat. And it wasn't long before we had sold out the Star Bar and sold out the Earl, and we were just like kind of stacking up the packed venues in Atlanta. And it was pretty awesome because, you know, a lot of bands complain that, you know, they're famous everywhere else. When they get to their hometown, nobody gives a shit, you know. But for us, it was like the exact opposite.
Yes, safe to say you are appreciated elsewhere as well now. We're talking to Bron Daler. He is the drummer and also sometimes vocalist for Mastodon, a fantastic heavy metal band founded in Atlanta almost 20 years ago now. They're on tour again for their 8th studio album called Emperor of Sand. They're going to be at the Fox Theater later this month. Bron, let's talk about your musicianship. You are known as a tremendously proficient, advanced drummer. You've been compared to Neil Peart from Rush. Let's, in fact, play a little clip here of you just really ripping on the drums. Now, in addition to playing like that, you also have just this voice of an angel, Bron. Like, you have this sort of high tenor voice that is very reminiscent of that voice that was very, very popular and sought after in 70s rock bands and is not heard so much today. But amazingly, like, you were not the singer in the early iterations of Mastodon. When did you start realizing that you had this golden gift in your throat that you could give upon the world?
I could always sing, you know. As one of the, my mother was a singer, my grandmother was a singer, and my grandfather was also a singer. They all sang in their respective bands that they were in, you know. So I was always in like choir and select choir in school and stuff, and then in the van early on, you know, when throw on Iron Maiden or King Diamond, I would sing along at the top of my lungs. Or if I was drunk at a house party, that's when, right, you know, it would really, that tenor would really come out and people would be shocked. My God, man. But with the early Mastodon stuff, it really didn't make any sense for me to be singing because I don't have that kind of really tough, growly voice, you know.
Yeah, it was all screamy stuff.
It was all screamy stuff.
But now you're singing melodic stuff. And in fact, let's play a clip so that people can hear what we're talking about. Let's play a clip from, I think this was the lead-off single of the new album, Emperor of Sand. It's called Show Yourself.
We've always been, you know, very much a band in the way of contributing. So it takes all of us to get it done. So I can do that, and then I can write some lyrics, you know. So I'd write some lyrics, and then I'd go into the vocal booth and I'd sing how I felt like it should go. And then either Brent or Troy would go and mimic that, but in their own voice, of course. And then around 2008, we went to record Crack the Sky, which was a lot more sort of proggy and had that very small window of 70s prog that was like early Genesis, yeah, and King Crimson and Yes and all that stuff. So I went in and sang the first part of it, and everyone really liked how it sounded. Tried to get Troy to replicate it and try to get as close to whatever vocal quality that everybody was picking up on that they liked about the way my voice sounded with that particular part. Tried to get as close as we could. And then we listened to it back, and it was really super close. But I think it was Brent, and he was just like, "Man, I don't know. There's just something about Bron's voice on that part. It just sounds. That's why would we not use it if it you know?" So we gave it the old college try, and it didn't work out. And so then I had to strap on the bit, as I call it, and get in there behind the drums and start figuring out if, in fact, I can actually, you know, pull it off and sing convincingly while being on an exercise machine.
Mastodon had a sort of a breakthrough single a few years ago called The Motherlode, which got you on late night TV and stuff, and you performed the lead vocals on that song. Let's listen to a little clip of that. And man, I would watch you on TV doing that song, and I'd be like, how is this man breathing? I mean, how do you physically accomplish playing the drums and singing like that?
I really couldn't tell you. You know, it's a lot of practice, you know. It's a whole...
I mean, are you in good shape? Do you train?
Do I train? I don't know about that. Yeah, I eat a lot of beer and drink a lot of pizza. But other than that, you know, I play drums every day, you know, for a couple hours, you know, and I play very intense, you know, and I play fast, and I play as hard as I can, you know, and kind of going through it so that I'll be physically ready to play when we go on tour. As far as like my conditioning is concerned, you know, I always play longer, much longer than we're actually going to be on stage, just to be completely ready for it. And, you know, we have like Red Rocks coming up. So that's in Denver. It's going to be up there in the altitude, and it's a little bit tougher on the lungs, but I don't know. You know, I really have to stay super healthy. It's a whole new thing for me to be worried about, which is really fun because I love to worry, and it's one of my favorite things to do. If I wake up and I don't have any anxiety, I start kind of searching my brain for what I can be worried about, and I'm like, oh yeah, that. Oh, good. Yeah. Thank God. Let's just cuddle that little nugget of worry. You know, it's one thing when you get sick and you're playing drums. Like, I've played with the flu so many times, you know, and the performing, you just can't call in, really. But vocals is a whole other beast. You know, you really have to be in sort of tip-top shape if you want to be able to hit those high notes and really be able to give a good performance. You have to be very healthy, you know, and it's hard to maintain that on tour just because, you know, you're just collecting no sleep, basically. So that's the most difficult part of it, I think, is really just trying to make sure you don't get a cold and try to make sure your throat is healthy. And, you know, you're doing 3-4, sometimes 5-6 gigs in a row, and, man, you can feel that fatigue on your throat. So I try to do everything I can to combat that and be as good as I can for the audience, because they deserve that, because they paid a lot of money to come see us, and they don't want an out of breath dude singing those songs. So I try to be as good as I can.
Let's get away from music and talk a little bit about policy, because this is public radio after all. You, Braun, and the rest of the band, or the rest of the guys in Mastodon, have been advocating for something called the Music Modernization Act, which is a piece of legislation that has a lot of bipartisan support in Congress and seems to be going places. And it's something that would essentially make it easier for artists such as yourself to get paid for plays of your music online. And surprisingly, it's something that is supported by the people who would be doing the paying, by the digital music industry. They are generally supporting this legislation. National Association of Broadcasters is supporting it as well, with a couple of reservations. What's this all about?
Basically, just because of the drastic way that things have changed and the way that people consume music with all the streaming sites like Spotify and Pandora and Apple, the artists are, the royalty rates are like almost nothing, you know, it's, I think, and they have a legacy act clause where anything pre-1972, they don't get anything. So you're just, there's so much music pre-72 that's in Spotify that people are listening to every day, millions upon millions of streams, and those artists aren't being compensated in any way. And the artists that are being compensated it's such like table scraps that, and if this is the way that people are going to be listening to music and enjoying music, then the artists are really going to suffer. It's putting every single artist, I don't know if you've noticed, but concerts are, there's so many bands and groups that are out on the road, and they're kept out on the road and just exhausted, and so the music is going to start suffering. There's just not going to be enough of it going around unless the people have another stream of revenue. There's money being made, you know, but it's going to the wrong people. It's filling the pockets of people who aren't creative, you know. The music laws that are on the books are, I mean, legislation is always miles behind because, you know, life happens and things change, and then law has to play catch up at some point. But it's been so long. It's been like since the early 70s, since there was anything new. And they're still operating under copyright acts that are from 1909, the player piano era, you know. So things need to drastically change.
We're talking to Braun Daler. He is the drummer and vocalist for Mastodon, the great heavy rock group founded in Atlanta almost 20 years ago. They are touring on their 8th studio album now, called Emperor of Sand. They're going to be at the Fox Theater on May 16th. Really briefly, Braun, you mentioned earlier that Atlanta was really good to you guys in your early days, that you really had a strong base of fandom here before you started branching out. What's it like to come back and play the hometown now?
It's amazing. It's always amazing. It's a little overwhelming and kind of stressful whenever you play any kind of like hometown, because everybody wants to come out, and everybody wants to see you, and everybody wants a high five. And I don't mind giving out 200-300 high fives in an evening, but the backstage gets so incredibly packed. Those Primus guys, they're not going to know what hit them. They're going to be bummed.
Oh, yeah.
Out.
Hey, you're playing with Primus, the great 90s progressive funk rock, whatever you would call Primus, is going to be with you. That's fantastic.
Yeah, that is fantastic. I love Primus. Saw them in the early 90s, and then I saw them again in the early 90s, and, you know, they're an amazing band, and with a lead bass player. That's crazy.
It's electric.
Yeah, but the Fox Theater is amazing. Yeah. It's an amazing, amazing place to play. It's an amazing building and so much history there, and it's such like an Atlanta thing and an Atlanta staple. You know, we talked about it from the beginning of our career. Once we moved beyond like the basement shows and stuff, we started playing like Center Stage and Masquerade a bunch of times. You know, since Troy's the only one that's really truly from this area, like he grew up in Stone Mountain. He would always say, man, I don't know if we could ever swing it, but man, if we could play the Fox Theater, that would be so cool. It's an honor to be in that building. You know, it's such a beautiful place. And like I said, so much history. It's awesome to be a part of it.
That was Braun Daler, drummer and vocalist for the heavy metal band Mastodon, with my colleague Adam Ragusea. Mastodon thunders into their hometown Atlanta May 16th. For more information, just go to gpbnews.org/onsecondthought. We'd love to hear from you. Who are your favorite heavy metal bands or artists from Georgia? Give us a call. Leave us a message at 404-500-9457 or post a comment on Facebook or Twitter. So let's do a quick recap of the week. We talked about the environmental issue of dog poop, which just really means pick it up. Don't let it wash down into the watershed, right? TransFitCon and immigration practices in Georgia. So as we do every Friday, we've gathered a group of really smart people to kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened this week. It's time for the break room.
The United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
George Zimmerman has been charged with a misdemeanor for allegedly stalking a private investigator working on a film about Trayvon Martin.
We're from Yemen.
Oh, good. Yemen's not even on the travel ban list.
Yes, it is.
Okay, joining us in the break room. How is everyone? Everyone okay?
Yes, Tony. Happy right. Friday.
Good to see you.
Happy Friday. Let me do a proper introduction here. Freelance writer Anjali Njeti is with us. Greg Williams, host of the radio show Greg's List. Where can I hear that?
It's on americaswebradio.com.
Outstanding. Emory University's Senior Director of Marketing, Tamika DePriest, is with us and also joining us by phone due to a flight delay. He's in travel hell right now. And there's part of me that says, let's give him a break in the break room today. But the more dominant side of me is like, let's give him further hell today.
Sounds good.
That's just me. Ed Sohn is with us. He is the Vice President for Product Management and Partnerships with Thomson Reuters. Ed, how are you, really?
At this point, I think I'm ready for anything. Right. Either way.
Okay, let's get started here. The reboot of ABC's Roseanne has aired since March to big ratings. It tackles relevant issues, most recently Muslim panic, head on. Roseanne is concerned to learn that her new neighbors are Muslim and shows it in this clip, which gets this response from her sister, Jackie.
You can't just stand on the front porch staring at your Muslim neighbors. It's just so obvious you're spying on them.
Greg, are you enjoying the reboot?
Yeah, I am, actually. And you know, if you think about it, if you go back, you know, to the 70s and 80s, a lot of our sitcoms did address social issues at the time.
Are you thinking All in the Family in particular?
I'm thinking Jeffersons. I'm thinking... you know, even the Bill Cosby show, which unfortunately that's going to live in infamy these days. Different Strokes, that addressed a lot of poignant salient issues. So I think it's great that that's kind of coming back now where we're not shying away from things, but we're looking at it in a comedic light, which I think can reach a broader audience. And you know, I've watched the clip of it last night in prep for the show, and I thought it was very well done.
Anjali, what are your thoughts? And particularly when you hear a joke like the one we just played, and I can remember watching All in the Family, and I can remember laughing at it. And I'm wondering if I watched it today, I'm sure I would. I don't know how it react to it today. I'm sure it's on TV land somewhere. But what are your thoughts on the reboot?
You know, I mean, I think the issue for me is there's such a disconnect between who Roseanne Barr is in real life and the character that she's bringing back in this show. I mean, I really liked Roseanne, the first version. I thought it was great, and it hit on a lot of issues that, you know, people in America were talking about but wasn't getting a lot of attention from the media in the entertainment industry. I was a big fan back then. But it is troubling to me that there is this disconnect. And when I was thinking about this episode, I mean, the thing that came to mind to me was, you know, she supports an administration that has issued some Islamophobic policies. So, you know, that disconnect I find troubling. I mean, when I was thinking about the reboot of this show, you know, something I would have been excited about had... you know, I not had such different ideologies compared to Roseanne's politics. What I was thinking about was, in this episode, you know, how great it would have been if we'd had a Muslim American show where we could see that humanity through Muslim American characters written by Muslim American TV writers instead of this episode where we're again seeing, you know, a white family being afraid of people that look different than them.
Yeah. Are you able to separate the Roseanne's politics from the show itself? There's the show, there's Roseanne, or do you think that the both are combined at this point?
You know, to me, they're one and the same. I mean, I don't think you can really separate art from the person. I mean, we can pretend that all we want, but, you know, she is very still influenced by who she is politically. And that is being shown in the show, no matter how sort of heartwarming the ending is.
Sure. Ed, what are your thoughts on the reboot?
You know, I don't have a lot of thoughts on the reboot. I haven't been keeping track of it or watching it.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been seeing it in the news and you know, being reported on. And I think that this episode is a good example of exploring more freedom in entertainment today to actually get into some of these topics. I don't think that it needs to be, you know, the absolutely perfect nuance. Dialogue. I don't think every single opportunity to bring up one of these issues needs to be like perfectly balanced and totally represented. A lot of times it is just an expression of wanting to get an issue in the public conversation. And I applaud that in whatever form it takes.
Yeah. Tamika?
So to me, it's more of the same, but in an updated version. So what do I mean? We talked about All in the Family, and this show sort of curves to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't watch it, but also I didn't watch All in the Family, and in fact was not allowed
to watch it.
No, there were shows in my household I wasn't allowed to watch because my parents thought it reinforced stereotypes. Yes, shows brought up issues, but there weren't really structured scenarios outside of the home to kind of talk about these things and the sort of lighthearted comedic edge to it,
But now,
was not necessarily a good thing.
But the woman that you are now, you know that those issues that were talked about in a show like All in the Family were real issues in the country, and there were people saying these things for real.
Oh, absolutely.
And feeling these things and having these discussions, and, you know, George Jefferson was pushing back, right?
Right, absolutely. However, the reinforcement of stereotypes and the way in which we sort of take in media. At times, some researchers have let us know that we actually take social cues and norms from these shows. So even as we laugh, even as we talk and engage, we still don't move through a process that gets us to a point where we can eliminate that smog in our life,
if we can
think about that as pollution.
Yeah.
So
I just remember, I definitely remember laughing at a show like All in the Family and thinking to myself, oh my goodness, that's so ridiculously over the top. It's funny.
Mm-hmm.
But I take your point, Tamika. And we are back in the break room. Anjali and Jetty is with us. Greg Williams, Tamika the Priest, Ed Sohn is trying to get on a flight back to Atlanta. Let's talk about the Iran nuclear deal. President Trump has withdrawn the U.S. from the Iran nuclear deal, originally signed in the Obama presidency. It lifted economic sanctions that crippled Iran's economy if Iran agreed to limit nuclear activities. It was a central plank in Trump's campaign and a singular achievement of the Obama administration.
The United States no longer makes empty threats. When I make promises, I keep them.
So, Ed Sohn, let me start with you on this one. What are your thoughts on President Trump withdrawing the United States from this internationally negotiated deal?
Yeah, I think it's a mistake. It's hard to see it in a different light until I can understand whether or not there's a viable alternative coming out of this administration. The nature of that agreement was such that it didn't need to be retired in this fashion. It could have been built upon. It could have been revised. It could have been improved. It didn't have an expiration. It was something that had an international coalition. Iran was actually complying with it, and it was successful in rolling back major items and kind of milestones in their nuclear program, including, you know, a giant 97% of its uranium getting eliminated. I mean, it was actually working for the intended effect. I remember when it was actually sort of being brokered, and it was a watershed moment for Iran and sort of their newly elected president at the time, and really kind of opened a put down a real marker for a moment of transition and change. And I think that this is just unwinding and taking all the steps backward.
Yeah. So, Greg, this was an internationally negotiated deal. Think about the countries involved in this negotiation: the United States, of course, the UK, France, China, Russia, Germany. You get the stamp from the United Nations as well. Why did the president make this decision, you think?
Well, the treaty, if you will, was never done properly. It never went through Congress like it should have. It was unpopular at the time it went through. The only reason it survived was because of 42 Democrats employing the filibuster. So I would push back a little bit on how great it's been working. It also did have an expiration date in the mid-2020s where Iran would be able to go back to business as usual. We also rewarded them. We basically gave them their own money back that we had seized their assets, but they've been using that to cause mischief and terrorism around the Middle East. So I think it's going to turn out to be a very good negotiating tactic. I think Trump is not playing 4D chess like some of his defenders will say, but I think him being unpredictable is actually a good thing because these other countries now have to realize that there is a new sheriff in town. The uninstallation of Obama is 72% complete, and we're hitting a reset on a lot of our previous deals that maybe weren't working out for us.
Dismantling the Obama legacy, is that the goal of this presidency?
I mean, he ran on several of these issues. It's funny that he's getting a little bit of pushback because he's doing the things he campaigned on. It's such a rare thing for a politician to do.
Is the good being held hostage to the perfect?
Of course. The perfect is the enemy of the good, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Anjali, your thoughts on the president's decision?
You know, Tony, I find this frightening. I mean, I'm trying to envision a scenario where we don't go to war with Iran. This kind of undermines, you know, what all of these countries have been working toward. And, you know, I think that the ultimate price is going to be paid by thousands of Iranian civilians, innocent Iranian civilians. So I'm pretty terrified about
it. Do you believe that in some way, shape, or form, the other countries that I mentioned who are signatories to this deal will figure out a way to keep it in place? Or does the deal fall apart when the U.S. imposes additional sanctions on the Iranian regime?
You know, I don't know what the other countries are going to be able to do. However, I think it really undermines the credibility of the United States with those countries. You know, they needed our support, and we did give it for a very long time. So, you know, I'm not sure that all these other countries feel like they can rely on us, you know, for support.
Tamika, how about you? What are your thoughts on this?
I'm also concerned about this, you know, leading to war. I'm also concerned about our relationship with those who have actually been strong partners with us. And I am actually hoping that other countries can work behind the scenes, to do something to.
Yeah, sure.
Make some. I don't know. I'm so confused about what's happening coming out of this presidency.
I think there's a dilemma as to how much Iran was actually paying attention to the deal. The Israelis came out and showed certain levels of proof that they were not exactly abiding by it. I think we've got a lot of proof that they're in Syria and Yemen and several other countries attacking some of our troops. So I would argue.
But the Israelis have always been against the deal.
Of course. Well, Iran has said we want to wipe Israel from the face of the map. So they're going to have a little bit of a bone to pick anytime it looks like we're strengthening the regime. And when we bail them out by giving them a lot of their seized assets back, didn't that make the regime have a little bit more lasting effect? You know, if our goal is regime change.
So all of the countries that were involved in the negotiations on this are wrong, right?
A lot of them had financial interests in it, they were getting trade deals out of it. And I think that it's an opportunity for us to be able to go back to the drawing board and get it run through Congress. If Donald Trump's biggest contribution during his 4-8 year presidency, or less or more, who knows? Well, it won't be more than 8, but could be less. If his biggest contribution is bringing back normal order, where things actually go through Congress rather than living by executive order.
Normal order.
Okay. Then that's going to be, because he has rescinded a lot of the executive orders and he hasn't been pushing through major policies on his own. And he's been trying to go through Congress, and that is the normal order that this country should be. It's the checks and balances system, and if that's his contribution, that'll be a very significant one.
Which would lead
Go ahead. Just one comment on this.
Sure.
If we're relying on Congress to pass a new nuclear deal with Iran, then we will see a nuclear Iran. That to me feels a much more likely outcome than the direction it was going. I understand the kind of foreign policy stratagem, you know, around Syria, and there's a lot of complexity there, and I totally, you know, give credit to that. But it didn't require the unwinding of an Iran that was denuclearizing to accomplish some of those goals.
Moving on now. Last Saturday, and I'm still trying to figure this video out. I think it'll take. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping now. So that's Donald Glover, aka Childish Gambino. This is America. So the music video is full of symbols and shocks, right? And just surprises, and it's in your face. They range from Childish Gambino mowing down an entire choir with a machine gun, right? To dancing with school children while all kinds of mayhem is happening behind them, maybe making the point that while we're focused on entertainment, there are real life consequences happening in people's lives all over the country. I don't know. It's going to take me a while to figure this out. Tamika, what are your thoughts on the video?
I mean, each time I watch it, I see something that I haven't seen before. And it's definitely a statement on gun violence. I think it's also a statement in terms of sort of our children and not only what they're experiencing, but sort of what they're learning in a very violent, chaotic, and I think in this video, mindless, because you have people running through rioting. I mean, it's just all kinds of scenarios, and they all seem to connect back to violence in America, which some say is as American as apple pie.
Anjali, when you saw this video, what were your first reactions to it?
You know, I thought it was really profound, and I thought it was beautifully done. I would say my primary reaction, though, is that what are white and non-black people of color going to do now that they've seen this video? I mean, you know, there's all these think pieces going around online. People are talking about it at the water cooler. Is this going to be another example where we watch a viral video of violence against black people and white and non-black people of color don't really do anything about it?
Well,
I mean, we consume
it.
Why
won't it be that? I mean, the news cycle is moving so quickly now. Why won't it be something that dropped on Saturday and maybe we talk about it for a week? That would be a long time in the news cycle and we move on.
It would be. But I mean, I just, you know, it bothers me that, you know, people who are not black consume these narratives, you know, enjoy it. It's entertainment. And then we don't do anything about it. We're not... You know, we need to do something about it. I mean, and we've seen the real videos, right,
of
viral violence.
What's the do something about it?
You know, get involved. Talk to people in your community. Go to your politicians and say, hey, we've got to do something about bias in our communities. Talk to, you know, your law enforcement, city council, mayor. It can be done at a very local level. Ally yourself with Black Lives Matter or other organizations working for racial justice. But we've become the society where, you know, we see violence against the Black community and really only take it in as entertainment. And there's got to be some action behind it.
Well, that's clearly one of the messages.
Oh, absolutely.
That's
yeah.
clearly one of the messages
I just,
in the video.
I just hope it happens. I mean, you know, we've got the tools. It's just a matter of whether we carry it out and do something with it.
Ed, what was your reaction when you saw the video for the first time?
Totally stunned. I thought that it, you know, Donald Glover's one of the sort of kind of brilliant young minds in art and entertainment today. I do think that, you know, I agree with the sentiment that we need to respond and that it's evocative as a work and it should evoke, you know, further response. I would love to see more artistic response. I don't think that art by itself is, you know, without sort of political action and fruit, is meaningless. I think that there is a massive sort of movement that could trigger. I think that young people watching something like this and kind of understanding it from a meta level, understanding that somebody decided to make something like this, would encourage others to make something like that too. And I think that there is a lot of political speech and expression and, you know, influence into our culture and into our way of thinking and our way of being educated and discussing and viewing issues in today's world when it's expressed in creative ways. I hope that it creates a watershed movement because I agree that one music video could drop on Saturday and be forgotten a week later. But, you know, 50 music videos that credits that music video or pieces of art or, you know, op-eds or poems or whatever, what have you, that sprout out from that, from inspiration, I think could be a really powerful thing.
And connecting to movements and activities that are happening now that are aligned toward addressing this. As there's actually a lot of community organizing and activity happening right now. If you think about Black Lives Matter, if you think about, you know, there's so many organizations, NAACP. I'm not going to go down the list, but there are lots of organizations, ACLU, there are lots of organizations that have activities and movements to address some of the things that have come up in that video. But I think it's to our panelists' point, what are other communities going to do, or how will other communities join into that movement that's taking place?
Mm-hmm. Which brings us to Greg, our white male on the panel in studio this morning. Not to put too fine a point on it.
Token. Well, you know, I had the, you know, fortunately I was able to watch it before reading the comment section and before really reading
it
was a great move because I watched it. I found it provocative. And then I started reading some of the comments, and the people were complaining about his dance moves. And I was thinking that was a self-fulfilling prophecy. You're missing the larger point, my friends. And the fact that that became a talking point on this video, that clearly that was shows, you know, when you have the shiny obelisk, hey, look over here, you're trying to distract from what's really going on in the background. But I was able to focus on the background the whole time. And, you know, there is a real good chance that this will be a viral sensation and disappear within a few months.
Though. I think so. And yeah. I'm sorry to say that. I'm sorry to say that. I'm wondering where the good music, the inspirational music, the provocative music out of this moment in time, right? Who are the artists producing that music? And maybe this is a start.
Tony, you may be right, because when I saw it, it harkened me back to that era of hip hop that sort of shaped my coming of age, which was Public Enemy, mm-hmm. KRS-One, X-Clan, these artists that basically were really had a high level of consciousness.
And they moved you.
As artists, and they moved us. So maybe this is the beginning of the floodgate.
Okay, more music. Ready? Last one. Taylor Swift announced the end of her longtime feud with pop singer and rival, can I say that, Katy Perry. She decided it would be poetic to send her a literal olive wreath with a note, as in she's extending the olive branch. So help me here. Was it Katy Perry who sent the peace offering, or was it Taylor Swift who? I think it was Katy Perry.
It was Katy.
Okay. So, Tamika, your thoughts on this? Do you have any deep thoughts on the end of this rivalry?
I'm smiling because I thought it was pretty cute for her to send the olive branch and the note, especially since Taylor, her point of view was she started it. And so I thought it was a good ending. I think it lasted too long. But what's funny is we had these sort of two pop stars, you know, having this fallout. I'm used to that in hip hop.
Biggie versus Tupac. This is certainly not Biggie versus Tupac, was it? I think it's interesting we juxtaposed from going to something very heavy to now cotton candy pop music.
Because it's Friday in the break room.
Frenemies. We've got to head into Friday night in a good mood, right?
I'm
glad we have Pax Romana between Taylor and Katie.
Seriously. I mean, I feel really bad for celebrities because every little tiff between them, every argument, every slight is magnified about a million times.
You're the
online.
Only one in the room. You feel bad for celebrities.
I'm not even a fan of Katy Perry or Taylor Swift. Don't tell my kids that. But I mean, it's like everything is exacerbated so much by how much people talk about. I mean, you can't just have a good old fashioned argument and just let it go.
But
right?
Theirs lasted for years.
Right.
Theirs lasted for years.
It did, right? So I mean, I do have a little sympathy.
And Ed, jump in here.
The only thing I got to say is that I follow Taylor Swift on Instagram. So, look, you know, everything being broadcast across the social media channels and stuff, that's, I'm a willing consumer and participant in that.
Well, tell us Levity. Why they keep picking on her. Perfect, why do they keep picking on her?
No, we don't have time for that. Thank you all so much. That's our break room. And thanks to our guests, Anjali and Jeanette, Greg Williams, Tamika DePriest, and Ed Sohn. And Ed, get home soon and safely. That's our show for today, but we always want to hear from you. We talked in the break room about Childish Gambino's new music video, This Is America. What do you think? Give us a call at 404-500-9457. This is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. Have a great weekend.